May be seated. Court has two files in front of it this morning that have been consolidated. Sheriff Kevin Thome and Colonel Rick Miller versus Steve Barnett and South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws, number 29546. And then the second appeal is 29547 in the matter of the election contest to Amendment A. We have actually both parties appear on both matters, and one side is an appellant and the other side is appellee, but I understand the parties have agreed by stipulation that South Dakotans for Better Marijuana Laws will be treated as appellant, and we'll be arguing first. Brendan Johnson will argue on behalf of appellants. Lisa Prostrello will provide a 15-minute opening on behalf of Mr. Miller, and Robert Morris will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Thome for 5 minutes. Who's going to go first? Okay. And then we'll have a 10-minute rebuttal from Mr. Johnson, and then a 5-minute rebuttal from Ms. Prostrello just on the 547 appeal, the Amendment A election contest. So each side set out the times, and you'll get a warning light at 2 minutes, and we'll to let you know when your time is getting close. With that, Mr. Johnson, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and honorable counsel. I am going to start off asking the indulgence of the court with a brief introduction, because I do think, and as this court has shown in the past when you've reviewed the power of the initiative, that the history does matter. And of course, in South Dakota, with our Constitution from 1889, it was in some ways really a pretty radical document. Under God, the people rule was a statement that was more than just words, but reflected the founders' belief that the power of government comes from the power of the people. The people's power doesn't come from government. Government's power comes from the people. And taking that and putting it into action, our state became the very first in the country to have direct democracy, to give the power of the people to initiate legislation. It wasn't ever designed as a secondary power to the legislature. It was the power of the legislature reserved for the people. That's how it was designed. And there was destined to be tension when the people had the power of direct democracy. It wasn't a bug in the design. It was how it was designed intentionally, so that when we had a situation where we had an executive branch and a legislative branch that might see things very differently than the people, that the people themselves could act as a legislature. Now we forward to 2019 and 2020. We're at a time in our country where cannabis is no longer a novelty. We look to our sister state of Colorado, and we see how that they've done it there. Cannabis is grown substantially in popularity in South Dakota, but we have an executive branch and a legislative branch, for their own reasons, who don't agree with the policy of legalizing cannabis. So the people utilizing their power, following the rules of getting the requisite number of signatures to put something on the Constitution, giving the people enough time to study it before they voted on it, the people put forward Amendment A to legalize cannabis in South Dakota. Now, we had an election. 55% of the voters agreed to legalize cannabis in South Dakota. Historically, and one of the principal bedrocks of democracy is when we have an election, it's final. That is the people's expectation. But that's not what has happened here. There is a lawsuit that was filed by those who were very aggressive in campaigning against Amendment A, who believed very strongly that the voters were making a mistake Then after the votes were counted, the lawsuit was filed. It's based on two issues. Now, I'm going to go and jump directly into those two issues rather than talk to the court right away about standing and latches. Those are both important, but they're both well-briefed. And I think we want to make sure with our limited time today that it's a constitutional issue specifically that we speak to. So first, the first issue is the single subject rule. The single subject rule, as it has been applied by this court, has historically served as a shield, not as a sword. It is designed to shield the people from legislation or crafty legislators who, before legislation passes, they will insert a rider or pork barrel politics, something that the people weren't expecting. They would have no reason to expect that this could happen. That has been the purpose of the single subject. Same when it comes to amendments. Is there something in the amendment that is so outlandish, so outside the bounds, that the people of South Dakota couldn't possibly have known what it was that they were really voting for? That didn't apply here in South Dakota. We had a vigorous debate, probably the most intensely scrutinized piece of legislation in my lifetime, in a generation, that the people ever voted on. All the media attention that is here today, this was heavily scrutinized. Now, when we look to the court's jurisprudence and how you have interpreted the single subject rule, I think the case, as I look at it, that is absolutely most on point is Barnhart versus Herseth.
Mr. Johnson, is the one amendment, one vote clause that was contained in our 1889 Constitution a single subject rule?
It's a really great question, Your Honor. And that's certainly how it had been applied by the court. The court, is Justice Salter, as you know, the court had applied the single subject consideration previously. And of course, we have Amendment Z, which is an issue of first impression, but certainly the same principles had been applied before, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how a proposed amendment could. So, if you've got in our more contemporary formulation of Section 1, Article 23, how a proposed amendment could violate the single subject rule and not violate the one vote, one amendment rule. And I've thought about it, but maybe not enough. And I'm trying to figure out how they relate to one another and whether there could be a violation of one without offending the other.
Right. I've wrestled with it too, Your Honor, and I think it's a good question. You know, as looked at the legislative history that was raised by both sides, what seemed clear, and of course legislative history is never 100% consensus, but what seemed clear was the idea that the same rule that applied to the legislature should apply to the people when they initiate legislation. And if we accept that to be true and certainly to be fair, then it would seem like the same rule that this court has applied with a single subject in the past should continue to apply today. And again, Barnhart is the most instructive case. There in Barnhart, of course, we actually had a congressional revision commission, which when it came to the executive branch and the amendment, I want to make sure I get this exactly right. Every section of the executive branch provision was changed. What happened is they transformed more than 160 boards, commissions, agencies, really bureaucratic and political fiefdoms, into 16 departments, each led by the governor's appointee. Barnhart himself talked about how he had lost his elected position, and it hadn't even been something that had been explained to the voters. But this court in Barnhart upheld it. And the reason why is because it had the purpose and the subject of making our government more efficient and responsible.
Do you see any distinction during that particular process between the fact that that was first vetted through a commission over a lengthy process as opposed to what occurred here with Amendment A?
I think that's a really fair question. And you hear the same amongst the legislators where they say, But, you know, through the legislative process, this goes through caucus, and there are ways that we vet it. The people, when we have our direct democracy, we have our own way of vetting. And, of course, the requirements that have to be met before it gets placed on the ballot. But if you were to go on the average street corner right now and test a person's knowledge of Amendment A that legalized cannabis versus their knowledge of any piece of legislation that got passed during the session, I would guess that they would say that they would know more about cannabis and what this did.
Of course, this was much more comprehensive than just a pure statement or a single statement saying we're legalizing marijuana in all forms. It's much more broad and expansive than that.
Yes, when we say much more broad, but I think the argument that we certainly had was, because especially when we take something that has been prohibited and then we legalize it, just like the state did with industrial hemp. That was a pretty broad statute when the state has considered what to do with industrial hemp. It needs to be. It needs to be. We want to have regulation in place. We don't want to have on July 1st. We've had this lengthy argument, and it goes into place July 1st, and there is no sort of regulatory infrastructure in place. So, there is more to it.
I want to go back maybe a little bit more, and maybe you didn't finish answering the question, but more foundational, when you're talking about regulating cannabis, you have, in Amendment A, you have recreational marijuana, you have medical marijuana, you have hemp addressed, all three of those subjects. States are all over the board on that in terms of regulating those three types of items that come from cannabis plant.
Correct.
So that's what we have in Amendment A. That's what the voters voted on. We have some indication from the initiative that the voters strongly favored medical marijuana, 70%. You look at the counties, a lot of those counties that voted the other way on Amendment A said, yeah, absolutely, we support medical marijuana. We don't have the same kind of outcome where we can determine whether the voters would have voted the same way if it was recreational marijuana standing alone. Is that problematic?
I think we, as this court has said, we go in with the appreciation, with the assumption that the people knew what it was that they were voting for.
Right. Yep. They may have known, but they may have said, they may have made the choice. I really favor medical marijuana. I think it's something that helps me health-wise.
Right.
Or a physician may have said that's a positive thing for my patients. But they may have said I don't care so much for medical marijuana. I don't think we need that. But I want this one so bad I'm willing to vote for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a matter of being informed. That's a matter of maybe the term log rolling, isn't it?
If the people wanted medicinal marijuana, of course, they had that option on the ballot. And as you pointed out, they voted for it overwhelmingly. The fact that you had fewer people, but still a pretty significant majority, 55%, that voted for Amendment A, I think shows that people did study it. And you have more people that are comfortable with medicinal than they are with recreational. But keep in mind, Amendment A, had the small provision essentially instructing the legislature to put in place medicinal marijuana. You need that, just like you need the changes with hemp, to draw that there is going to be a distinction when we're talking about the subject of cannabis. There is a distinction between hemp and a distinction between medicinal marijuana. But in terms of the argument that, well, hey, this was log rolling. No, the voters had the option in front of them to just do medicinal marijuana. But they had a lengthy debate on whether we should have recreational.
Would there have been issues with supply of that and how that gets, A is much broader in terms of cultivation. You have growers authorizing people to come in and market it, both for recreational and medical.
Mm-hmm.
With the initiative, you don't have that. And so, don't you have a supply problem if you just have the initiative?
I think there, if you were, I think with people of what they were relying on is that the legislature, that different entities would come in and fill that gap. and that is how that it would be addressed. Let's be clear. People can have different purposes for voting for a piece of legislation. That is, some people voted for this legislation because of a criminal justice, and they thought we were arresting too many people. Some people voted for it because they want to have cannabis. That's okay. We can have a bill that people support for many different reasons, and maybe exactly as you said. Maybe some folks with medicinal marijuana said, well, I want to make sure that I have this right. It's okay to have multiple reasons to support it. What's not okay is if we were burying something in there, if the people of South Dakota had somehow been tricked or fooled into Amendment A.
Does the standard for determining that, does the standard change itself, or is it just viewed more deferentially depending upon when it's challenged, before or after the election?
Right. What this court looks to is whether there is a plain and palpable violation of the Constitution. But part of our latches argument here, which I do think comes into play, is when we talk about the damage that could be done if for the first time in our state's history, we have a court that literally throws out 417,000 votes that were cast on a piece of legislation duly passed by the people, the harm that could do, especially in time when people already, too many, feel like elections are rigged anyhow, the standard should be exceptionally high. It should be exceptionally high, Your Honor, after an election.
Doesn't Barnhart sort of support your argument in that regard? Not necessarily that there's a different way to view it before or after, but Barnhart seems to suggest that once we've had an election, we indulge certain presumptions, or we view the prospect that you have unrelated topics in an amendment, perhaps with a little more deference. I don't know. That may not be right, but maybe there's an argument there, and I don't know what your feelings are. I'll ask the other parties as well.
Right. I think that's right. And, of course, Barnhart is one of the few cases. So many of the time this was brought as, for example, a writ or something of that nature. Barnhart is the prime example where the court will be particularly deferential and exercise that restraint to not utilize judicial activism when you have had an election like this. And you look at, just the cases that are cited in Barnhart as our Supreme Court. They looked at the Minnesota case. And they said, well, the purpose of that was, well, it was about the burdens of being a legislator. Or the Idaho case where they completely changed how the executive branch worked there. The court was particularly deferential. And of course, when we think about wholesale changes, which this state has seen, and we saw particularly in the 70s with the executive branch, but also the judicial branch, there were a lot of reasons that went into those changes, and people supported them for many different reasons.
Counsel, isn't it equally important to follow the self-restricting provisions contained within the initiative process?
Mm-hmm.
Primarily the single subject rule. I count 15 subjects and 55 mm-hmm. subsections, as noted in opposing counsel's brief.
Correct, right.
Certainly was very little publicity about the far-reaching implications. So, for example, the Department of Revenue,
mm-hmm.
vesting it with exclusive power.
Right.
Or the decision to appropriate where the taxation will go to. I'd like you to address that concept.
Right. Well, and of course, the number of provisions has always been less important than what the provisions themselves do. When it comes to the exclusive power of Department of Revenue, because you're going to hear a lot about that. So the language here is extremely important. And this is, when we talk about the exclusive power, this is actually what it says. The department shall have the exclusive power, except as otherwise provided in Section 10, to license and regulate the cultivation, manufacture, testing, transport, delivery, and sale of marijuana to the state, and administer and enforce this article. That is not revolutionary, and all due respect to opposing counsel. What we see every year from this legislature is that they will delegate powers to a different agency. When we talk about the exclusive power to the Department of Revenue, it means that they're not sharing it with the Department of Health, which they might do in the situation of medicinal marijuana. This is a simple delegation of power. When we talk about Colonel Miller and the Highway Patrol, we have a number of former prosecutors who sit on this bench. If we were to advise the State Highway Patrol and how Amendment A affects their day-to-day responsibilities, it would be extremely limited, right? You're not going to have a suppression issue because of the way that it's drafted. Almost everything that they did before Amendment A, they'll continue to do afterwards. This isn't a wholesale revision of our Constitution. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Somewhat, yes.
Okay. I have a minute left. If there are questions, I'll wrap it up. But if there are any other questions, I want to make sure I get that before I sit down. So when we talk about Amendment A, when we talk about single subject scope, just in terms of some of the things that this state has done in the past, what have we done? We've, for example, Independent Bankers versus Meyer Henry. It governed bank holding companies, insurance, taxation of insurance companies, bank sales, and provisions. And the subject there was a regulation of banks and their subsidiaries. Canale versus the state. That's when we closed down the college in Yankton and we made a prison. And what did we say? But it dealt with the closing of a university, establishing a prison, and also laws dealing with what happens when prisoners escape. Meyer Henry versus Huron. The subject matter there was municipal finance. We can go on. This court has consistently exercised the conservative principle of judicial restraint, and that is called for at no time more so than when the people of this state have voted for legislation that was duly enacted. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Parstello, you may proceed with your initial 15-minute argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I want to be clear that this case is not about cannabis. It's not about medicinal marijuana, and it's not about the multitude of other subjects that are packaged within Amendment A. It's about the rule of law, and it's about enforcing the limitations that the people placed on their power of initiative under the Constitution. Those limitations are essential to preserving the integrity of our state's founding document. The Circuit Court recognized this when it struck down Amendment A, and we're asking this court to do the same. There are two primary issues before the court. Does Amendment A violate the one subject rule, and is it an unconstitutional revision? The answer to both of those questions is yes, and it comes down to an interpretation of Article 23 of the Constitution.
Should we read the text of Article 23, Section 1 of our current Constitution, similar to the question I asked Mr. Johnson, should we read that differently than the version of Section 1 which existed by virtue of the 1889 Constitution, which was at issue in Barnhart and also Harriet?
I think to answer your question, I want to begin by noting that there, under the current version of Section 1, there are actually two different standards encompassed within it. One of them I refer to as the separate vote requirement, and that has existed in our state constitution in the past. The language was slightly different, but substantively, it was the same. The one subject rule is new to our state's constitution, having been added in 2018 with the ratification of Amendment Z. Those are two different requirements. And with respect to the separate vote requirement, this court has talked about what standard applies on at least two primary occasions. Those cases are in Harried and Barnhart. And in those cases, this court asked itself when determining whether we were dealing with one amendment that needed to be, or two that needed to be separately voted upon, this court asked, what is the purpose of the amendment at issue? That was the focus of the court's analysis. For example, in Heried, the court stated that the subject matter of an amendment must be incidental and necessarily connected with its intended purpose. Similarly, under Barnhart, this court held that the subjects of the amendment must be rationally related to a single purpose or plan.
Is there a different requirement for the one subject clause which now exists in Section 1?
I think there is.
What is it?
I think we start from the premise, because this court has not yet defined that standard in South Dakota, we have to start from the premise that the one subject rule means something, imposes some restriction that is in addition to or different from what is imposed under the separate vote requirement.
Can you think of a scenario in which an amendment would violate the one vote, one amendment rule and not violate the single subject rule, or vice versa?
I believe that the single subject rule, or as I call it, the one subject rule, is a more burdensome standard. It's a higher threshold, in fact, than the separate vote requirement. So I think there could be a scenario where an amendment violated the one subject rule, but not the separate vote requirement, but the inverse would not be true. Because this court has not yet addressed the one subject rule, it's helpful to look at what other courts have done in defining the standard. Various courts have used different language, but overall the concepts are very similar. And the questions the courts have asked themselves are, for example, do the subjects have a natural and necessary connection? Are they interdependent, or could they stand alone? Or are they closely related and similar in effect on each other, on either procedural or substantive law?
I'm sorry to hang in there on the text, but if you will bear with me for a minute. Does the one vote, one amendment, or the separate vote clause, as you call it, does it apply here?
It does.
The text of the Constitution says that if more than one amendment is submitted at the same election, then we have the one vote, one amendment rule. Was that the case here?
We had just...
Amendment A is the only amendment we're talking about here, and it seems as though that's the only amendment that the proponents suggested. So do we have a situation where, as it relates to this amendment, we had more than one amendment that was submitted at the same election? And if we don't, does that provision even apply?
I think it does apply, and it applies because the language that this court has used when analyzing the separate vote requirement provides a threshold standard for evaluating Amendment A. The court asked, what is the single purpose of the amendment? And in this case, it can ask itself the same question. What's the single purpose of Amendment A? Is it the legalization of recreational marijuana, medicinal marijuana, or hemp? Is it the funding of public schools, perhaps, or revising our state's tax scheme? Or perhaps is it granting the Department of Revenue exclusive constitutional authority, which is something that's unprecedented in our state? Or is the purpose of Amendment A to create a new cause of action against a state entity that did not previously exist? Or perhaps is the purpose of Amendment A to restrict this court's authority to discipline members of the bar? All of these are separate purposes encompassed within Amendment A. All of them can stand and fall on their own. Within the 15 sections and 55 subsections of Amendment A, there are an array of different subjects and different purposes. Any of them can constitute a single subject, but combined, they violate the single subject rule, without question.
Ms. Purcell, I want to go back maybe to more of a procedural question in terms of this being in front of us now post-election. The proponents make an argument that this could have been challenged before the election. And I know you respond to that in your brief, but I'm just thinking about a mandamus action. And you've got this issue with, we don't think that that this is properly in front of the voters, and we want to challenge it. The Secretary of State shouldn't put this on the ballot. Is there a reason that that couldn't have been brought before the election, before the people voted on this, and they could have, the court could have decided the one subject issue before the people voted?
Your Honor, the issue in this case is that there was no clear procedure for bringing an action before the election. Thankfully, the legislature has now addressed that, so it won't be a problem moving forward. But there was a question at the time. And in fact, this court has stated that when a case is deciding whether a change in the Constitution has been legally effected, that question is actually better addressed after the election.
That's Cramer and Riff.
Correct. And that actually does make some sense, because there's judicial efficiency factors to consider here. If we were to bring an action before the election, that might not have ever been necessary if the amendment were defeated. That's a waste of judicial resources.
But Cramer and later Riff suggested a couple of things. One, that its principle of suggesting restraint was based upon concepts of separation of powers. So there's that. And although it's clear that the voters can change the Constitution when they want to and when they follow the rules, I don't know that the voters constitute an institutional separate branch of the government. But even leaving that off to the side, with the principle that recommends and the admonition of intervention against intervention apply in a case like this, where the substantive legality of the amendment is not at issue, or at least not in this proceeding in front of us. And rather, what's at issue are the technical requirements that are imposed by the Constitution for presenting the amendment in the first place. Not whether it violates the law as a substantive matter, but whether the correct procedure was utilized. And it seems, leaving the cases off to the side for just a minute, it seems at least that might be prudent to allow a court to intervene to say, well, who knows what the voters will do and whether it will ultimately be upheld on substantive grounds, but technically, the requirements appear to have been satisfied. That seems to be this case. Cramer and Riff seem different. What are your thoughts?
I think that this case is very much like Cramer and Riff, and that's because this is actually in the nature of more a quasi-substantive proceeding. Determining whether Amendment A complied with the constitutional requirements for ratification and for placement on the ballot.
I read your briefs to indicate you're not challenging the substantive legality of this provision. Am I right in that regard?
You are. But determining whether the procedural requirements of the Constitution have been met necessarily requires a review of the substantive language of Amendment A and its effect. This court cannot determine whether Amendment A is an unconstitutional revision or whether it violates the one subject rule without evaluating the substantive content of the amendment and considering what effect it will have on the Constitution and our system of government.
And in making that evaluation, should this court look to other states, or should we rely on our own prior precedent, although technically this is a case of first impression? And I see Mr. Johnson supporting the notion that we look at principles in Barnhart and Harriet versus looking to Montana or Nebraska or Oklahoma as referenced in your brief.
I think depending upon what particular issue the court's analyzing, authority from other jurisdictions can be very helpful. We cited in our brief authority from Nebraska, Montana, and Oklahoma. In all of those cases, the courts have provided very helpful direction on what constitutes a single subject and when that rule.
The Wagner case in Nebraska isn't very helpful, though, to you on that topic that you and I were just discussing. Because in Wagner, the Supreme Court of Nebraska did make the distinction that my question suggested, which is a distinction between technical requirements for presenting the amendment versus substantive legality.
Well, but at any rate, I do think that there is a distinction, and there is no time limit upon when the governor can institute a lawsuit to enforce the Constitution. We cited in our brief several examples of this court reviewing amendments after they had been enacted or proceeded through an election. There's no specific time bar for challenging the constitutionality of Amendment A. If there were, that would be particularly concerning because it's implying that the passage of times can somehow sanction constitutional invalidity. In essence, we're applying an equitable remedy to overrule constitutional mandates, and that is not the role of the court. In light of my limited time, I do want to briefly address that we're not only challenging Amendment A based on its violation of the one subject rule, but also the fact that it constitutes a revision to the Constitution. It constitutes a revision for several reasons. In our brief, we identified over 22 different constitutional provisions that would be affected by Amendment A. Unfortunately, I don't have a time today to address each of those constitutional provisions. But suffice it to say, Amendment A will have significant and lasting effects on our Constitution if it's allowed to stand.
Article 23, Section 1 seems to contemplate precisely that. It indicates that a proposed amendment may amend one or more articles in related subject matter. It just has to comply with the single subject rule. So is the fact that a number of amendments or areas, topical areas, are affected, does that in and of itself make this a revision versus an amendment? Because the amendment article seems to contemplate multiple amendments being impacted by a proposed amendment.
I think the question is, what's the subject or purpose? Is there a single subject or purpose? And if that purpose must be carried out through affecting various amendments, or excuse me, various articles within the Constitution, that may be acceptable. But for example, the Montana court, when discussing the one subject rule, mentioned the fact that we do need to look at what constitutional provisions are impacted by the amendment when evaluating whether it is in fact one subject. If it has an effect on various areas of the Constitution that are unrelated to each other, if the purposes are not one, then it may in fact violate the Constitution. I believe with that, my time may be up unless the court has any additional questions.
Thank you. Mr. Morris, you have 5 minutes.
Chief Justice Jensen, justices, good morning. My apologies for taking time away from Ms. Prostrato. I represent Sheriff Tome, and my focus for these few minutes is going to be on the issue of his standing to challenge Amendment A. The Constitution is a supreme and paramount law. The people in Article 23 have set forth the rules that apply to amendments to the Constitution, whether it be by the legislature or by the initiated measure through the people. Sheriff Tom has the ability to challenge and has the standing to challenge Amendment A as being in violation of those rules. As to the election contest, he signed a verified complaint and met the requisite requirement to be a registered voter and also was named in his official capacity. As to the declaratory judgment action, he's the plaintiff in his official capacity as a sheriff of Pennington County. First reason he is given that standing in his official capacity is because he took an oath to support the United States Constitution and the Constitution of South Dakota. The Constitution of South Dakota.
In our Edgemont case, I'd like you, if you could, in your limited time, Mr. Morris, just get to that. I think it may be very helpful, at least for me, to understand how you view that case. And
sure. Well, the Edgemont case, there were the Edgemont School District and Fall River County challenged the constitutionality of the statute. And this court made the determination, no, you cannot, you as a county and you as a school district, you were created by the legislature. And the legislature created the statute, which you're asserting is unconstitutional. So you're a subordinate. You cannot, as a subordinate, challenge the sovereign. Sheriff Tome is not the county. He's the duly elected sheriff of Pennington County and isn't here on behalf of the county, isn't using county funds to do this. He's the elected official.
His office is created by statute, though, is it not?
Well, at best, his office was continued by statute. His office, as Pennington County Sheriff, was established back in 1877 during the Dakota Territory combination of North and South Dakota. That's when the first sheriff was appointed, was 1877. And his ability or his status as sheriff has been in existence since 1877, prior to the establishment of the South Dakota Constitution in 1889. And the county, he's not here on behalf of the county. So it's not where he is a representative of the county. He's an independent elected official. And part of the process is, or part of the standing is that by statute, he's charged with keeping the peace in his county, and part of that is public safety. Now, this case is about the rule of law, but with Sheriff Tome, with the small issue of standing, it is about cannabis and marijuana. The public safety and the burdens that are placed on his office as the sheriff surely will be heightened and affected by the legalization of marijuana. There's also issues, with marijuana, you don't have the ability to do PBT tests and those sorts of things. So what comes into play is a person under the influence, is a person impaired by the ingestion of marijuana and those sorts of things. So those are the various concerns that he has. Also to the point of Edgemont, the court in Edgemont string cited to a number of Iowa cases. And those Iowa cases, and the court agreed, those Iowa cases said that a political subdivision lacked standing to mount a constitutional attack against a state statute. We are not attacking a state statute. Our assertion is that we have an amendment which is in violation of the Constitution itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Johnson, you have a 10-minute rebuttal. I'm sorry?
15 or
10? 10 under 83. I think that's what the party stipulated to. Is it?
I'm certainly comfortable with whatever the Chief Justice wants to tell us. So. Either way, one of the questions that I feel like the two are interconnected from both Justice Devaney and Justice Kern, which is one, this is a long constitutional amendment, as you pointed out, with a number of sections. And Justice Devaney, with your question, well, we did have the revision committee and we did have the amendment studied under Barnhart. But we had a group of constitutional professionals. We had a committee who studied it. And I think that those questions really do kind of interconnect. We have a long constitutional amendment here. Where did it come from, and is it all necessary? And I will say, first of all, I have no doubt that others could have written this amendment better. But, of course, that's not the test. Where it did come from is we have six states in this country that already have cannabis in one form or another in their constitution. What we did when we crafted Amendment A was to look at legislation from other states, including constitutional amendments. And what we did was actually to streamline it somewhat. Because again, when you are taking something that has been previously prohibited to the people and you are legalizing it, that is going to, by nature, create a broad statute. But it was not something where, you know, we had dreamed up. It does come from other states.
Did the other states on which you modeled this also submit it all as one amendment?
So I would have to go back in terms of, I think Colorado may have, and of course some states in their constitution may have medicinal and some may have recreational. There were. So when I say six states, I'm not saying all six states did it exactly the same as South Dakota. But of course, Colorado also has a single subject rule, which is similar to South Dakota's. So that's what we patterned it after. Could it have been drafted better? Couldn't the court find exceptions to it? Yes. But I think the key issue is was it done constitutionally and lawfully? Did we have the requisite number of signatures? Absolutely, we did. Did we get it in time? Absolutely, we did. Did we violate the single subject rule? We did not. And again, as we look to past cases, the Meyer-Henry versus Huron, the Constitution does not restrict the scope or magnitude of the single subject of a legislative act. Same applies with the Constitution. 55 sections is an awful lot. But is it part of a singular scheme where we are taking cannabis, which has been illegal, and legalizing it? I would say that it is. As the court said in Baker, the provision, provisions governing projects so related and independent as to constitute a single scheme may be properly included within a single act. So, yes, it is a lot. Parts of this are clarifying, again, with law enforcement, that we are not stepping on their toes. Part of it with the Department of Revenue is saying that we are delegating these powers, but limited ones, administrative, regulatory, not legislative, and not law enforcement.
So with regard to the 1972 changes, it did appear that, you know, there, it was a broad scope there, but that the provisions that affected each department of each branch of government were dealt with in separate amendments. So that appears to be a little bit different than what we have here, where you have a number of branches of government that are all impacted by one amendment. How do you resolve that, or at least how do you see that comparison?
Well, and first of all, I don't know. So, and of course, that's not part of it. Is does it affect other branches? Well, of course, any time amendment is going to take powers away from one. But what is the impact of Amendment A on the judicial branch? You know, what we have done is when it comes to licensing, right, making it clear that that the state bar, when it comes to licensing, can't revoke. But other than being able to no longer adjudicate less than an ounce of marijuana, how is that affecting the judicial branch? When it comes to the executive branch with the Department of Revenue, we specifically say in there the Department of Revenue or its successor. Who appoints the Secretary of the Department of Revenue? Right? This is not a massive restructuring of government by any means. In fact, and this is really interesting, it's on page 60 with the letters back and forth to the Legislative Research Council, appendix page 66. It actually talks about Section 6, which I think is really important because we're talking about this exclusive power, right? So we submitted this, as we were required to the Legislative Research Council, and we followed the vast majority of their recommendations. One of the original parts, as you'll see here, that we included was making it clear that other than Amendment A, we were not restricting the right of the legislature to govern in this area. And what they told us is, as proposed, Section 6 provided the legislature with the authority to implement the amendment, provided such legislation is consistent with the intent, purpose of this measure, and its stated requirements. This language has been removed. The language has been removed. That was by the SDLRC. The reason why is the legislature is already constitutionally empowered to enact legislation and is already required to legislate within the bounds of the Constitution. This is not some sort of wholesale revision. What is a revision? In Oregon, they say it's fundamental and far-reaching. In Delaware, it's a change to the basic philosophy of government. In Michigan, it significantly alters or abolishes the former structure of government. This is not that. This is legalizing cannabis. And it does touch on some parts of the Constitution, but not in the manner in which the opponents have claimed.
If we go back to the single subject issue once more, do you think, is there any distinction between that limitation on legislative acts versus constitutional initiated amendments, in your view?
If there is, we didn't know about it when we voted on Amendment Z. That was not part of the discussion that when we approved a single subject rule, that it was going to be subject to heightened scrutiny when the people amended our Constitution.
The reason I asked, I just noticed there was some language in the Harriet case that referred to the reasons for preventing combining legislation is more forceful when submitted to the electors than the actions of the, when it's submitted to the actions of legislators. And it was referring to because the legislative process had it built in the ability to make amendments mm-hmm. along the way, whereas the voters don't.
Right.
So it's a take it or leave it proposition.
In some way, that is it's certainly true, right? And we could go back and forth as to, you know, I'm personally a fan of initiated measures because of look at all of the attention that it has received. The people of South Dakota, the electorate, find another piece of legislation that they're more invested in and more interested in and they've studied more closely, I think that we would struggle. But I understand people who say, look, no, this legislation should start in caucus and it should be subject to amendment and it should go through that process. That is a fair argument to have. But I would say that the founders, when they reserved the power of the legislature directly for the people, they made that determination for the court. They can be co-equal. There can be the same power of we the people in the legislature as the legislature in the state capitol. And those processes were different back then, and they knew it, than what they are now. And they knew that it would create a tension because the time you initiate a measure is when the legislature disagrees with it and the executive disagrees with it. The processes are different, but they're both important. And they're both fundamental to who we are as a state. I'm almost out of time. I want to say this in terms of the latches argument. This really does get down to the issue of the difference between a procedural violation. Based on their argument, this was clear before the people voted. Okay, and a substantive violation, which doesn't come into effect, the person's right is not taken away until the issue has actually been voted on. This court, from a policy standpoint, if nothing else, needs to say and articulate, you can't wait on the sidelines. If you see a violation, which apparently they did from August of 2019, the time to bring that is before the election, not after 400 plus thousand people have voted. If you do, you chill this entire process by waiting. I'm out of time, but thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Prestrelli, you have 5 minutes.
I believe my remaining time is to be restricted to the election contest proceeding, which is what I will address now. And I want to begin by noting that the purpose of an election contest is to determine all questions that are relevant or material to the ultimate questions of whether the official determination of the result of the election is correct. The only exceptions that are recognized within the statutes are proceedings to determine the accuracy of the official returns or a recount. Neither of those exceptions obviously apply here. Now, election contests can be brought to challenge the determination of an election regardless of whether there are specific procedural irregularities in the conduct of the election itself. In the statutes, election contest is defined as a legal proceeding instituted to challenge the determination of any election. That's precisely what Colonel Miller is doing in this case. Because the election contest procedure is a product of statute, that definition is what controls. Now, Colonel Miller is challenging the determination of the election on Amendment A because the proponents failed to follow the proper constitutional procedure set forth by the people in their constitution. Amendment A cannot represent the will of the people if it is enacted in contravention of the people's constitution. That's the fundamental problem. And Amendment A violates not only the one subject rule, but also it violates the requirement that a revision must be subject to a constitutional convention for proper vetting. And I want to note with my remaining time that we are seeing the consequence of that lack of scrutiny and deliberation that otherwise would have occurred if there had been a constitutional convention. And we see that through what Amendment A does with the Department of Revenue. Under our current system of government, the Department of Revenue is a subordinate agency. But Amendment A changes that. It grants the Department of Revenue the exclusive power to regulate marijuana. And exclusive means what it says. Amendment A does not state that it's the exclusive agency with power. It is the exclusive authority. And the problem with that is Amendment A now has taken what was a subordinate agency and elevated it to an agency with original constitutional exclusive authority over marijuana regulation. If the legislature were to enact a law that conflicted with a regulation promulgated by the Department of Revenue, the Department of Revenue would control because it is the one afforded exclusive power.
Maybe that's the next case, though. Maybe that one awaits us.
If and when we come
to that point, maybe we would have to construe that text in concert with all the provisions of the Constitution and determine which one has primacy and whether we can read them together. Maybe we're not there yet.
We are there, and this is that case, Your Honor, because the fact that the Department of Revenue is granted exclusive power has a very real effect, and it has an effect on Colonel Miller and the Highway Patrol specifically. Because under our current system of government, the Highway Patrol has been granted or delegated authority to enforce all laws on our state highways. That's an authority that the legislature delegated to the Highway Patrol. But if Amendment A is allowed to stand, that all changes. Suddenly, it's the Department of Revenue that has the exclusive authority.
But how does that transform the amendment to a revision? Isn't that the nature of an amendment, that the people, through their vote, could do something different, tell the legislature we want a different rule? The Highway Patrol's cognizance over whatever it has cognizance over at this point surely isn't constitutionally based.
It is constitutionally based.
It is.
The reason that this amendment is a revision is because under our current constitution, we have three branches of government that are afforded specific delegated powers. Amendment A changes that. It elevates the Department of Revenue to effectively a fourth branch of government with exclusive power. That's a fundamental change to the basic structure of our Constitution and our system of government. That makes Amendment A unlike any other amendment that this state has ever seen. And it's the reason that this court should strike it down today. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank counsel for your arguments today. The case will now be fully submitted, and this will conclude our April term of court. Thank you.